Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is New York Times Assistant Managing Editor and the former Washington Bureau Chief, Elizabeth Buemiller. Remember, we love taking your questions, so writing to politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can also get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. Now tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Every Plate and ZBiotics, in our show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors because it really helps make this podcast happen. Hey, James, our guest is Elizabeth Buemiller, once with the Washington Post, chiefly with the New York Times. She's been a foreign correspondent, White House reporter, political reporter, among other assignments, and for almost 10 years directed the New York Times Washington Bureau, which under her leadership did some of the most important stories of our era. She's free at last. She's back to reporting. And this week, she wrote about fear and loathing in Washington that faces the Trump wrecking ball. Elizabeth, that was a fabulous story. And with a change of administration, there always are people leaving and people coming and different policies and different programs. But your story describes something far different and more radical.
Yeah, yes. What I have learned just from being a reporter since January 1st is how the culture of silence and fear in Washington and beyond, because of Trump's vow to seek revenge and retribution against his perceived enemies. And it's really striking. It's not just, of course, it starts with, you know, Republican members of Congress in the Senate and the House, but it spreads to, universities, into business, journalism to some extent, think tanks. It's kind of everywhere, and people are just so afraid of speaking out, to the point that, a professor of government at Harvard, Stephen Levitsky, said that this, to him, he was the co-author of that very influential 2018 book, How Democracies Die. So this is just a sign that we're sliding into some form of authoritarianism, because when people are so afraid to speak out against the government, that's a really dangerous turn of events.
Well, it's chilling. Law firms that represent clients that Trump doesn't like, big law firms, Covington, Burling, right, and others, are having their security clearances for any of their
correct
lawyers pulled. And I hear that some major law firms, particularly New York ones, just won't participate in any of these critical legal challenges for fear that Trump and the Justice Department would come after them. That does have elements of a police state or authoritarian state.
Right. Well, we're not there yet, because there are people are speaking out. There's a guy I interviewed, Michael Roth from Wesleyan, is one of the few university presidents who's directly criticized Trump and Vance by name, and he's also criticized their takedown of DEI policies. But he's a lone voice. Now, he may not have as many research grants on the line as some of these other universities do. For example, Columbia University, we saw what happened with them this week, that the Trump administration canceled $400 million in grant funding. This is universities' livelihood, bread and butter. And this is also about, science research, math research, really important research for our future.
Yeah, the University of Pennsylvania is cutting in half its graduate admissions for next year. A number of those will be medical students who won't go, will be medical students, STEM researchers. They're going to pay a price down the road. I think it's terrible policy. The government has a right to do it. I mean, I think it's a bad thing to do. But the U.S. attorney in Washington is threatening Georgetown University's law school. That's a private Jesuit institution, over its diversity policies. That's what I think is more like a police state or a mob. They have no right to tell a private university, a Jesuit school, that they don't like their particular diversity program, but they're doing it.
I didn't realize that was happening. Wow. Well, I was just outside in Washington. I was watching them, the jackhammers taking apart the Black Lives Matter, mural that was embedded into the, with bricks and into the, into 16th Street, leading right straight down to the White House.
Yeah.
And that's, if you go outside now, you'll see it's a lot of dust and, construction. It's just all coming up. It's such a metaphor for what's happening.
Well, you talked in that fabulous Times piece on Monday, you talked to some Republicans and some Republicans in Congress. They have only slim majorities, but Trump really owns them. I mean, is that because of loyalty, fear, partisanship, what?
It's all of the above, but the main thing is that you saw just this week, Thomas Massie was threatened. Trump, I think 2 days ago, threatened him with a primary, threatened him with setting up a well-financed primary opponent because he dared to vote against the spending deal in the House. But that's been going on, and he's got Elon Musk behind him. He's got, Elon Musk just contributed $100 million to Trump political operations. So he's got Elon Musk to finance all this for him. So it's fear of being primary, but obviously senators are only elected every 6 years. So what are they afraid of? Well, some of them are afraid of just their families, the security of their families. People told me, there was one person I interviewed, very prominent first term critic of Trump, who said that he did not even want his name in the story that I had tried to contact him because he said, every time my name appears in public and print, the online threats against me just go increase. And Republican members of Congress say this, and the senators say this is also what happens with them, and they're scared for their families. Look what happened to Nancy Pelosi's husband.
Right.
And we all know the threats against members of Congress have really increased in the last 10 years.
James Carville.
So, Elizabeth, I obviously know you and knew what you did and knew you professionally, and I do what everybody does. Before the thing, I looked you up in Wikipedia. We might be kin. You ever think of that? You were born on the Jutland Peninsula. Your dad was Danish.
I'm going to come to Elizabeth's defense.
Oh, your mother was Danish.
My mother. My father was American. Yes.
Okay,
my mother was
born in Denmark, right?
I was born in Denmark. Yes.
Right.
I'm an immigrant. Yes.
Right. My great grandfather, who was an immigrant too, was born in Copenhagen, and I go
really?
To Bank Street where his house is. So maybe, as horrifying as it might be, it might help.
Wait a minute. So you have. Place. So your great-grandfather was Danish?
Yes.
And then, so who came to this country then?
He did.
What year did he get here?
Oh, I'd have to look probably late 1870s, something like that. No, maybe before that, maybe the 1840s. But he was a very good, he still has a patent on sugar refining. He was like an engineer.
But that's interesting, but I don't think there's any sugar.
I'm sure it's been passed by now, his last name was Slangerup, and there's a little town right outside of Copenhagen called Slangerup that actually has a famous church.
Isn't that interesting? Well, I never would have figured you to be Danish.
I always find out something different. I got a lot of friends there. Alan Leventhal was our ambassador, his old friend.
Yes. I know him. Yes. He just got back.
I really do. All right.
Well, that's something, a Buhl-Miller Carville relationship.
Yes, yeah.
Wow.
Connected at birth. You've seen a lot, maybe as much as anybody. And we're having this, what I refer to euphemistically as the problem of drinking from the fire hose. You can't. What are a couple of three things that you have seen that? Oh shit! I mean, and it's hard to pick them out. I'm just going to be very careful. But what are some things that just even made an experienced person like you, who's seen everything, just become bug-eyed?
Well, I think just from starting most recently was. President Trump's continuing insistence of having Canada become the 51st state. I mean, it's crazy, right? But he keeps on it. And he was talking about it yesterday outside the White House in a way that was just, it sounds like he's been thinking about it for a long time. And these, the tariffs, it just doesn't seem to make any sense. But what is astonishing to me is that the Canadians are taking it seriously. You know, we've heard from Justin Trudeau that this is not a joke. And we saw what happened in the election a few days ago. And the irony is, of course, is that if Canada should become the 51st state, we would never have a Republican president elected again because they're all liberal. But that's one thing. The other thing is I'm surprised by the tariffs. You know, I was one of these people who believed that these were threats, and yet it seems like he just can't give it up, and he's willing this time to endure a tanking of the stock market, which he couldn't stand in the first term. So that's been a surprise. And I guess I was surprised by the way he shut down USAID and now the Education Department. He seems like a man who will probably thinks he's going to lose a lot of support in the midterms and is just moving in the next year and a half to do everything he possibly can. Those are just three things off the top of my head. There's so much more.
To know my ancestral stories, from a lot of ancestors in Ireland, we go there often. And of course, the wisdom of a Dublin cab driver could never be second guessed. I was in a cab and I said, "What do you think about reunification of Northern Ireland, Republican Ireland?" He said, "Goddamn, we can't run the 26. What are we going to do with another six?" I mean, the 26 counties in a Republican Ireland and six in Northern Ireland. It just in some, my idea, can we get to 50 straight before we start talking about the 51st? We got a lot of work left to do at the 50, you know? I mean, sometimes you got to segue into humor to deal with this, because if you think about it seriously, it'll literally drive you crazy. And I'm happy to report that Louisiana, always at the forefront of stupidity and jackasseries, Board of Education named it the Gulf of America. But we had to lead the way, because we had the first pedophile priest. Okay, so we have to lead the way in stupidity, and our Board of Education is holding up our reputation for being the dumbest, stupid people in the fucking United States. But at any rate, no, I'm just editorializing here. But so you look at the times, and they're obviously have become very aggressive, and there's a lot to do. How do you think your paper's coverage so far in this? And this is, I know I'm asking an employee, but if the editor said to you, "Elizabeth, how do you think we're doing, and what could we be doing better?" What would you answer?
Well, I'm not going to criticize my own paper. There's a new bureau chief in Washington. Dick Stevenson is doing a fantastic job. But I think the only thing I think Dick would say is that there is so much, and it's, as you said, it's like a fire hose every day, and it's hard. It's very hard to keep track of it and keep up with it. And I think I think the bureau is doing a very good job of stepping back as whenever it can and trying to put things in perspective and in context, because right now it's way worse than the first term of Trump. It's just like 17 things happen every day, and the New York Times covers the presidency, it covers the news, so we have to take note of them. But it's a lot to absorb. I mean, after the State of the Union, I was talking to Dick Stevenson, and I said, "My God, we had every single story on the phone in the morning on mobile was like seven or eight in a row. They were all Trump related, which is normal after the State of the Union. But it's like, you know, I needed something else, you know. So it's just the nature of the business right now." But I do think the Times is doing a good job of stepping back. You know, Eric Lipton's pieces, we had a fantastic piece that our new Washington editor, Matea Gold, edited on inside, you know, Elon Musk's takeover of the federal government. And that was really powerful, just showing, you know, how they turn up at these agencies, you know, in the middle of the night and in their all black dress and come in and take things over. And there was very good reporting about how this was planned months ago. It was not just us, you know. So well, I was very proud of that. Okay. But okay, you're not going to, I'm not about to, I mean, my colleagues here in the Washington Bureau are just killing themselves. I mean, it is nonstop. Oh. And, you know, it's like we have our readers, I remember in the first term would say, can't you just ignore him? You know, no, he's the president of the United States, but you know, that's, we can't do that. So
as hard as I try, I can't. Yeah. Tell you about Albert.
Well, I think, you know, you raise a good point, Elizabeth. I mean, every day I talk to someone who is, most of them are well-informed, and either they tell me something I'd never heard of, or right. I tell them something they had never heard of. Like, you know, he called Mark Kelly a traitor. Or, I mean, there's nobody better informed than Elizabeth Buemiller, and you didn't know about the Georgetown Law School. That's because
I
there
did
is
not.
So much.
Yeah, I can't read it all. And, you know, I can't blame readers for saying, I can't deal with this anymore. I need a break, you know, because it's, you know, if you have a certain liberal's perspective on the world, every day it's just, you know, education department is shutting down. USAID is shutting down. You know, Trump is going after these lawyers. I mean, it was every single headline is if you have that perspective on the world, is bad news.
Yeah. Will Elon Musk continue to be unchecked? I mean, there is no accountability or very little accountability there. They've gotten rid of inspectors general. There's no congressional oversight accountability. So, and some cabinet members, which the Times revealed a couple days ago, are complaining. But Musk has just, it seems to me, he's just unchecked.
Well, I think that's an example of a really good scoop by Jonathan Swan and Maggie Haberman. That inside that the big blow up between Secretary of State Marco Rubio and mm-hmm. Elon Musk, and to some extent Sean Duffy, the Transportation Secretary. I do think there is, and I know from my reporting that there is a lot of concern among the cabinet members. This guy, as you say, is unchecked. He's ordering, you know, he's trying to take over basically their agencies and firing people without, they're not part of it. So that was the first significant pushback to him, to Elon Musk. I don't know what the future is. I don't, you know, everyone, the betting is that he'll stay. It doesn't seem in normal politics that this is sustainable, right? You and I know Washington. Yep. This is in the old Washington. This would not be sustainable. We would know this would be over in a matter of weeks or even maybe a month or two. I just don't know. Trump obviously likes having him there because he likes his money. He can dangle a primary threat against an opponent. He likes ordering around the richest man in the world. Basically, he's his IT guy. He's his staff member. You know. Trump values money. Elon's the richest guy around. And, you know, he now answers to Donald Trump. And also, I think Elon Musk, you know, takes a lot of the heat off of Trump. He's more unpopular, certainly, than Trump is. So everybody's blaming Elon for the stuff that Trump wants to do. But I don't know. I mean, it's there's a lot of unhappy cabinet members. I think there's White House staff. They're not happy with this. I don't think any of them expected this. They were telling us in the weeks and days before the inaugural that, oh, Elon is going to really step down now and go back to his business as well. No, that hasn't happened. In the meantime, his businesses are not doing particularly well.
Yeah. I mean, they had to go.
I mean, his rockets are blowing up and his...
bring out the... you know, so, the other day I read that between Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and Zuckerberg, that they're all on the stage on January the 20th, that the value of their stocks has decreased by $200 billion since January 20th. So
so it hasn't been financially advantageous for
them.
Right. And again, Elon Musk's rockets are blowing up, and Tesla sales are tanking, especially in Europe, especially in Germany. You know, and you know, so we had this bizarre situation yesterday where Trump was, you know, like a car salesman at the White House saying, support my friend Elon.
But Elon is probably in a position to protect all of his defense contracts.
Correct.
Which will make great stories for your colleagues at the New York Times. Because
we've written about, Eric Lipton has written about many of those contracts even before he was here, and they are continuing. And you know, when you think about it, I will not. This is a very obvious thing to say, but even one of these events or scandals, one out of 50 right now, would be a huge story in a regular administration. It would be all we would be talking about. And now there are so many, we can't we can't manage them all, right. Correct? And so that was the other part of this shock and awe that Trump was planning in the first months of his administration.
Elizabeth, last week I talked to Larry Tye, who wrote a magnificent biography of Joe McCarthy and the McCarthy era. And Larry says it's worse today than it was during the McCarthy era, in his view. But he also makes the point, yeah, it's going to end someday. Maybe it'll be the 26th election. Maybe we'll wait 4 years. But as he pointed out, the McCarthy era ended, but it left some enduring damage that lasted for decades. And I think his point is that, yeah, some of this will stop, some of it will end, some of it will be countered. But boy, they're doing a lot of damage right now that you were not going to recover from. It may take years for the FBI to retain, to get back its credibility. The USAID is not, is gone. I saw Bill Gates at something the other day, which I think you were there, and he said what they're doing to PEPFAR, George Bush's, he says it'll take a long time. He said there are going to be really millions of people who may die because of this.
Right. And you wonder, the big question is what happens to our relationship with our allies. Right. If, as Trump seems to want, which is some kind of a grand bargain, grand alliance between Russia, China, and the United States, if that is actually his goal, then what happens to our European allies? I mean, they were wary about trusting us, during the Biden administration, because they were always nervous that maybe Trump would come back, and now this is what's happened. So I don't know. I mean, will they trust the United States again after Trump is gone, presumably for the last time? I don't know. It depends on if J.D. Vance is president. I don't know. But that seems to be really... I don't know what the future is there. Trump, the animosity towards Europe is quite something, with our oldest allies.
James?
So, Elizabeth, I'm going to offer, because I like to critique everything and who the hell cares, I'm going to offer a press critique and even a Times critique. And I think everybody's doing a good job on what Trump is saying and all the crazy stuff they're going. But I think the untold story is what he campaigned on. How many times did he say he was going to lower prices from day one? How many times he said there was going to be a booming stock market? How many times did he say the economy is going to go boom, boom, boom? So, of course, he gets in. It quickly dawns on him that he can't do anything about this. In fact, he's only making it worse. So in order to get people to forget about it, I'll talk about annexing Canada, the canal zone, the Greenland. I'll talk about every stupid thing that comes to mind that's never going to happen. And you know what's going to happen? They're all going to chase the story. And what else is going to happen is they're going to forget all of the promises that I made during the campaign. And then they're going to send somebody to a diner. And as they always do, is Press's favorite technique, because all wisdom is in a diner. And people say, well, I didn't vote for that. Now, look, I just to be clear, I was voting my paycheck. Just to be clear, I thought he was strong. And he's actually succeeded in deflecting us from all of the shit that he promised that he has no chance of ever delivering. In fact, just the opposite is being delivered.
Well, I'm just looking for our story. We had a story this morning. No, you make a good point. It's called the pig through the village point, that like you run the pig through the village and everybody looks at the pig and they don't look at what you're actually doing to the village. So, right. I don't know where that's a, anyway, yes. I think we actually, we cover everything he's saying now, but there was a piece, I was just looking for it on my phone, that either it ran this morning or I don't know, last night, looking at what he had promised and how he's done nothing. And people, he promised to blow things up and that certainly happened, but yes, the prices of eggs are not down. There's not a booming stock market. It's not a brilliant economy, all the things. So I think we do both, and I think we do have to cover. Look, when the Prime Minister of Canada says that we have to take Trump seriously and a whole election turns on what Trump is saying, I mean, we have to cover that.
I guess I'm not saying you don't have to cover that, but you also have to really be focused on all of the things he said he was going to do.
And I would argue that we
Okay.
I would argue that we have.
All right.
I do think that the Canadian, his effort at the threat to take over Canada does get a lot of attention. But should we just, you know, it was the same thing I went through when I was bureau chief. Every day it was, Trump would say something outrageous. And it was always the debate, do we ignore him or do we call him on it? You know, that was kind of like, he said it before, he's the president of the United States, but this is a big deal, what do we do with it? But if we were going to do it, we were going to have to say that he lied when he said it. So it was just every day we went through this. There's no right answer in as far as I'm concerned.
I think that this bone view, we don't cover the unkept promises or things that he promised he was going to do that he's not even trying to do. And I think that we have to consider the possibility that, I know you got to cover what he says, but some of this is to deflect attention from what he promised and what he's delivering.
We will do a story on that.
Okay. Thank you.
we will make you happy.
I love having you on the show, cousin.
But beating up on the New York Times is kind of a favorite sport of people I know.
You know, to get beat up on means you're relevant.
I know. They only boo
the Duke basketball team or the Los Angeles Dodgers. Elizabeth, I want to say
that's a sign that you matter.
Yeah, I want to say this one subject matter that I know a little bit about are Washington bureau chiefs, and there has never been a better one than Elizabeth Buemiller. She took over the Times with great talented people, but a bit of chaos, and she produced over almost 10 years. She led some of the great journalism that we've ever read, and she's already in only, 2 months, she's back to what's a much more fun job, being a reporter and doing a great job.
I would say that's, thank you, Al, but I would say, yes, it is fun being a reporter. Bureau's in very good hands. I did it longer than almost anybody. I had the second longest record of serving as bureau chief. You know who the longest was? It was a guy who was there during the Eisenhower administration, Arthur Kroc. Eisenhower, yeah. Kennedy. I think he started during FDR. He was bureau chief for 21 years. That was not going to happen.
He was Reston's predecessor.
Was he?
Yeah.
Arthur Kroc? Did you know? You didn't know him.
No,
did
I didn't know. No. But I knew Reston well. And what Reston had was a deputy named Wallace Carroll who really ran the bureau. But it was anyway. And I knew Wallace Carroll rather well. He was in Winston-Salem. And we would have lunch, and later with Reston, they would always complain about how difficult it was dealing with New York. That's something that
this is true.
Yes,
I got along pretty well with New York, but it was it's just, look, we're down here. There's almost 200 of us now down here. The bureau is huge, and New York is up there, and we're down here, and we have thoughts, and they have thoughts, and
Contention which will always exist is that both cities consider themselves the news capital of the world.
But we are the news capital.
Of course. That's why there's problems, because they don't understand it.
I think they do. Well, now with
Elizabeth, you have been a fabulous guest. Say hi to Steve and keep up those great pieces.
Say hi to Judy.
We'll do
it. If you don't want to be criticized, go work for the Sacramento Bee.
Okay.
All right. But the fact that you're being criticized is actually what you want, because people are actually reading you and care what you say.
Okay. Thanks, you guys. It was fun.
Enjoy a good and delicious meal with every plate. If you can get taste and, something nutritious at the same time, you never turn it down.
Right. And I really do think I speak for all of us when I say grocery shopping is always a pain. You have to stick to a shopping list, plan out recipes in advance, and then go play bumper carts with all the other shoppers. Enough is enough. After incorporating every plate into our lives, it can be so easy. Now we know what portions we're getting. You'll have everything you need to make your favorite meals, and you can spend less time shopping. That means more time enjoying delicious and nutritious homemade meals shared with family and friends. Not only that, thanks to every plate, Takeout is no longer a temptation. It's an easy choice. If you've been using takeout apps more than you've been exercising, it's time to create better habits and save money with Every Plate. Every Plate can help you dish up better habits with delicious, easy recipes that get delivered right to your door. They have almost infinite options, including new calorie smart, carb smart, and protein smart options. We love that their new smart swap recipes let you swap flour tortillas for lettuce wraps. Think of that. That's a pretty good trade. No draft choices. White rice for lettuce, potatoes for sweet potatoes, and other substitutions to make better meals. Don't wait. Start skipping the store and enjoy wholesome homemade meals that cost less than groceries right now. You can start with 50% off your first box with code WARROOM50 at everyplate.com/podcast. This Every Plate offer is valid with an auto-renewing subscription. So look for the link in our show notes. Hey, James, the Trump administration is hailing a couple of what they call big victories this week. They got Ukraine to agree to a 30-day ceasefire, and now they say they're pressuring Putin to do the same thing. And the House, on a partisan basis, passed a six-month funding bill to avoid a government shutdown. And the fear that I am channeling, former vice president and convicted criminal Spiro T. Agnew, I may be a nattering nabob of negativism. I think these victories are vastly overstated. For the budget extension, people don't understand. This doesn't deal with any of the big issues. This doesn't deal with Medicaid or tax cuts for the rich. It does have some bad things in it. It cuts money for mental health facilities. It cuts money for public defenders. It slashes a lot of money out of D.C. It's going to be very hard for the city. But mainly, it just is a continuing resolution. The big stuff will come up later. And on Ukraine, they're now going and they say, we're going to get Putin to agree to this. Vladimir Putin, if a despicable autocrat, is shrewd. And he knows that Trump desperately wants some kind of a peace resolution to claim that he did it and put in for a Nobel Prize. When he has Trump in this position, the president of the United States really is a useful idiot for the Russian dictator. And I must say that whatever they get done, I think Putin is going to come out a winner. And I hate to say that.
Well, all right, let's go back a little bit. And what our friend Ann Applebaum told us, that Ukraine is in a lot better position than people think. They have technology, they have weapons built up. 2 days ago, there was a story in the New York Times that basically Ukraine was kicking the crap out of the Russians, that they were having manpower issues, they couldn't advance, they're having horrible economic problems. My suspicion is that Putin needs a 30-day ceasefire. He's got to regroup. He's getting the shit kicked out of him. And he instructed Trump through his cutouts to propose a ceasefire. So that way, you look good, you look like a peacemaker. I got to get 30 days, I got to figure out what to do because I'm getting the crap kicked out of me. And I think that's the most logical explanation there is. And again, you can see the Times had a long story, and they quoted the Institute for the Study of War, General Petraeus' thing. They follow this thing very closely. And my great suspicion is Trump is doing Putin a favor by asking for that ceasefire.
I think you're right.
I mean, it's just like, it's unbelievable. You have to read the Senate Intelligence Committee report about Trump and Russia. I mean, it's not even a question, is Trump connected to Russia? It's been, look at what even Merle said. I mean, the Russian-U.S. contacts, entanglements, everything is just breathtaking. And we even voted with them in Belarus and North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
What explains that? Well, why are we doing Putin's bidding by trying to get a ceasefire when Putin's getting the shit kicked out of him? I think that this all points to the fact that they're just total tools of the Kremlin.
Well, the guy who is dealing with Putin is a real estate pal of Trump's named Steve Witkoff. And I want to tell you, when you want to put a real estate operator from New York together against Vladimir Putin, I fear I know how I'm going to bet. And I think that's...
They're not. Putin is telling him what to do.
Right.
They're not negotiating.
Right.
I need 30 days, bro. I got to get a breather. I got to get my shit together. It's not going well.
Yeah.
They don't know how to conscript people. They try not to do it in the urban areas because, you know, you don't want to piss off educated people in Russia. And they're running out of cannon fodder. You know, as I call it, the 12th Cannon Fodder Brigade of the Russian Army.
Yep.
Read that time story.
Will do. Okay. The only other thing I think we want to discuss is, because Elizabeth covered so much good stuff, is Elon Musk. Again, a lot of friction. People don't like him. There's only one person that really matters, and that's Donald Trump. And he appears to have Donald Trump. I couldn't believe, now that his stock has gone down, they're out in the White House grounds hawking his Tesla. I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable. Let's get Elon's stock back up. But James, what really hit me this week, that Musk, a immigrant from South Africa, I am for immigrants, as you know. I don't think he's ever seen a day in the military in his life. He called Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona, a combat veteran, a NASA astronaut. He called Mark Kelly, quote, a traitor, end quote. Now, in America, if you're a traitor, you should be subject to execution, right? And so what did Donald Trump do or say? He hawked his Tesla in the front of the White House. I mean, this is deplorable stuff.
Well, I saw what Musk said about Senator Kelly. And there is one person that's going to handle this, and handle it this person will. The ever odious Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon actually has, for whatever it is, I think it's a riff, but he has this kind of ethno-nationalist, anti-globalist kind of view of the world. And if you were going to give Bannon credit for anything, and I would be reluctant to, I'd say he's been pretty consistent in that. He hates Elon Musk. And I'll tell you one other thing about Bannon that most people don't know. When he was a younger person, he was a naval officer. And that will rankle Steve Bannon. He will use that to beat the living crap out of Elon Musk. And Bannon has a following over there. It's not us going on our podcast and talking to all of the other educated, you know, left-leaning people that agree with us. He's going right at the base and going right after Elon Musk. So I'm gonna let Bro Bannon handle this one. I think he's got it in his sights.
Well, I think I agree with you. Even though James, he shamelessly stole your name for his podcast and never has ponied up or apologized. But in any event, I agree. Well, we have lots to follow this week. Every week, as we said, as James said, it's like a fire hose. So we'll keep following it.
We should call ourselves the Genuine Roar. No pretenders here. It's the real thing. After a long night, get back in the game with Zbiotics. Well, you know, one of the truisms of D.C., and in most places, you never stop working. So you work at the office, and then at night you go to a cocktail party or dinner party or reception or whatever it is. You're working there. If you're a journalist, you're seeking people out, you're talking to potential sources. You know, if you're a diplomat, you're looking for something else, but you're working. There are very few, you know, other than Mardi Gras Christmas holidays or something like that, 9 out of 10 social events that we attend, there's some element of work to it. And, you know, there are libations there, And, you know, doesn't matter if you were at the British Embassy till 11:30, you still got to sit and file stories at your desk at 8:30 in the morning. And you couldn't imagine what a great tool this is for, or, you know, if somebody goes to some event in the local bank and you still got to go and work at the local bank at 8:30 in the morning. So it's invaluable for anybody.
Look, let's face it. After a night with drinks, we don't bounce back the next day the way we used to. Hard to say, but true. It used to be a big decision. Do you want a great night or a great next day? Luckily, with pre-alcohol, you don't have to compromise. To fill you in, ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Now, here's how it works. When you drink alcohol, it gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme that breaks this byproduct down. Just remember to take pre-alcohol your first drink of the night. Drink responsibly and you'll feel your best tomorrow. Now, thanks to ZBiotics, James even goes on long runs after his long nights, particularly during Mardi Gras. Every time you have a ZBiotics pre-alcohol before a drink, it makes such a difference. Now, after drinks at a dinner with a source or potential podcast guest, we know we can jump into action right after waking up, whether you're writing all day, exercising, or even going in front of an audience. ZBiotics is our MVP when it counts. Make sure it's in your lineup, too. This March Madness, don't let anything sideline your celebrations. Grab pre-alcohol before you go out and be ready to cheer on your team all day and all night long. Go to ZBiotics.com/PWR to learn more and get 15% off your first order when you use the code PWR at checkout. ZBiotics is back with 100% money back guarantee. So if you're not satisfied for any reasons, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/PWR and use the code PWR at checkout for 15% off. The link is in our show notes. All right, now for the outrage of the week. You know, the cruelty of the Elon Musk, Donald Trump stormtroopers really is deplorable. You know, all we've read about throwing people out with little regard to worth, President George W. Bush's signature achievement, PEPFAR, which is distributed financial assistance and supplies to over 50 countries to prevent HIV/AIDS, has saved about 26 million lives. Trump has suspended most funding for PEPFAR. One more. Thanks to the indefatigable Judd Legum at Popular Information, we learned that the Veterans Administration therapists are being forced to provide mental health counseling in open cubicles. This is part of the Trump demand that everyone return to work. But the VA doesn't have enough private facilities. They're forced to work with patients in cubicles, which the numbers say provides little, if any, privacy. The Health Insurance Portability Act, HIPAA, requires privacy for mental health counseling with stiff penalties, including imprisonment. That's just a nuisance for the Trump administration. You know, we know a couple of things, James. Number one, that mental health is a serious problem in the veterans community, and that B, good counseling can make a real difference. But the VA, according to the Associated Press, plans to lay off as many as 80,000 employees, and we don't know how many might be mental health professionals or contractors. Trump brags that he loves the vets as long as they don't cost him any money.
Well, if you think about it, the most sacred contract a nation makes is with its veterans.
Yeah.
And the idea is you defend our country, and when people do that, a lot of things happen, bad things, really bad things. And one of them is terrible stress that lives with you for the rest of your life. You probably have injuries, you lose a limb. But I mean, I could think of 1,000 different things. And the promise of the United States is, if that happens to you, the United States will provide you with health care, both physical health care, mental health care, just as important. I mean, the veterans have higher suicide rates. they have more mental problems. And just look, and you could, it's not very hard to figure out why. And what they're doing is breaking the most fundamental contract this nation or any nation can have, and that is the contract with people who fight to defend it. And, you know, Napoleon, he put out less in the lead, you know, like if you were in my army and you get injured, we're going to take the best possible care of you, which, you know, helps army recruiting, but it also is what any moral nation does. Of course, I don't, turns out government, we're no longer a moral nation. So from outrage, if bad words offend you or somebody is listening to this, you might want to hit the mute button. But in 1972, George Carlin famously said he was going to say the 7 forbidden words publicly. And the words were shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, and motherfucker. And he said it, and it was like a big deal. It was the 7 forbidden words. Okay, so it seems antiquated. It's kind of funny now. It's George Carlin. We know who he is. We laugh. This is what has happened to America. I am reading New York Times. As President Trump seeks to purge the federal government of, quote, woke, unquote, initiatives, the agency had flagged hundreds of words to limit or avoid, according to a compilation of government documents. Okay, this is, I think it's like 300 words on that. You can look it up yourself. Among the words, oh, I just highlighted a couple. Accessible, barrier, disability, woman, historically, political, equality. I could go on and on. We're banning these words. That's right. These are the kind of words that if you work for the federal government, you're not allowed to say. If you don't think this is, I don't know, Orwellian, is crazy, and look them up. Look them up. It's in the Times. It's anywhere. If you just Google Trump administration forbidden words, it's mind-boggling. Historically.
Well, James, if I want to talk about World War II, am I allowed to talk about the Enola Gay?
No. Oh, No. I mean, that was Paul Tippett's mother.
Right.
He named the B-29 that carried the bomb to Hiroshima. And it's so staggering. And the problem is, you know, it's the old analogy, but you know, it kind of works. It's like drinking out of a fire hose. It's just so much, you just can't get to it. You know, my favorite is the Secretary of Agriculture, who actually said in response to high egg prices, people should raise their own chickens in their backyard. So my plan is to take the Enola Gay, put chicken wire around it, like it's a chicken coop, so people can come see the Enola Gay is a chicken coop. It's so, these people are so goddamn petty, ignorant, stupid. I don't know what else to say about them. And it just, every time I do this, it doesn't make me want to get madder. It makes me want to see what I can do to be more effective.
You know, James, every time I get upset about the crazy Democratic left, I realize that number one, compared to the crazy Republican right, they are so small, and number two, they are so less lethal.
Anyway. They're perfectly nice people. They're naive and silly people, but they sit around and think of words that no one else knows. But they're not mean people. They don't want to hurt other people. They're just stupid jackass people.
All right, James, now our listener questions, they are really good. Here is one from you from Bob in Morro Bay, California. Any thoughts on Stephen A. Smith running for president on the Democratic ticket?
You know, since that's happened, I've rethought my position, and I think Stephen A. should run for president. And if he does, I will donate $500 to his campaign, because I'm going to tell this audience and Stephen A. exactly what's going to happen. I had a similar experience. I was 15 years old, 16, I forgot, and was thought to be the fastest white boy in the Carville area. And so somebody had an idea that we'd have a foot race between me and a black kid by the name of Babut. And his, what happened in the South during segregation is everybody got all excited and people got the cars. It was at night. And they had their car lights on. And, of course, all of the black people in the cars on one side and the white guys in the car on the other side. And Babut and I were running barefoot, indeterminate length. Maybe it was 50, 75 yards. And I think I saw him for the first 5 yards. Then I lost contact, all right, because Babut was that much faster than I was. And that's what's going to happen. You know, I thought I was hot shit. I was not. And if Stephen A. takes my $500 and runs, he's going to get on the track with a lot of Babuts. There's no shortage of Babuts in the Democratic Party. And Stephen A., as much fun as you are and as much as I like you on TV, when it comes to politics, you're not the equivalent of a Babut. I will tell you that for sure. But go ahead and run. You'll have my $500, and then you'll get to see what a really, really fast track looks like.
And Stephen A., if you hear this and you disagree, we'd love to have you on the show to talk about this. It's an open invitation, Stephen A. We know you, we know you're willing to stand up for your views. So here it is. Anytime you want to come on Politics War Room, you just let us know. Next, James, Ben in Atlanta says the Democrats were in a boxing ring trying to win a fight with interpretive dancing during Trump's speech. They knew it was coming. The best they could do was colored suits and ping pong paddle messages. That's like something a camp counselor would come up with. What would you have done? You know, we talked about this last week, Ben, but I'm going to repeat. It was awful. It was terrible. Poor Al Green made a fool of himself and made a fool of Democrats. The paddles were just sophomoric. However, and the real problem I have is it took away from what was a fabulous rejoinder by Alyssa Slotkin. If you want to know how the Democrats can win in 2026 and probably in 2028, go watch and read Michigan Senator Alyssa Slotkin's rejoinder.
I agree 1,000%. And what this was an invaluable lesson. It's hard. You know, when you and I have talked about this. I've written about it. Democrats need to be thoughtful, proceed with caution, have patience, and come in at the right time. And people took, I don't know, say offense at that argument, but there was a great deal of, you know, what are you talking about? We got to charge immediately. Okay, so you saw the charge immediately, Gavin Newsom and Molly Jong Fast, who's been on this show as a friend of ours. You saw that approach, and then you saw Elizabeth Slotkin, which I would call the Hunt Carvillian approach. And I think that it was so evident what happened that the Hunt Carvillian approach will be in vogue now for the foreseeable future. But it does not entail quitting. It entails timing. And in The Great Roadhouse, one of my favorite movies ever, you talk about toxic mail. I mean, they wouldn't let that movie within a 100-mile radius of NPR, but it's really fun. And Patrick Swayze was called Dalton, and he was the cooler, the bouncer, and he told the other assistant bouncers, be nice until it's time not to be nice. And that's be nice, and there's going to come a time when it's time not to be nice and then spring into action like Dalton.
Yeah, I totally agree. Let's hear it for Hunt Carville. That's the first time I've gotten the top billing. Yeah, I'm a little worried about that. George and Sherman Oaks ask you, he says, I'm all for the power of government to lift us up, but is the Department of Education the hill we should die on, given its results?
Well, I'll leave that primarily to you, but it does do a lot of essential things. I don't know if we didn't have a Department of Education thing until Carter was president. There's so many things that are so much more egregious. And, you know, this is something I'm trying to tease out in polling. What Trump does, he gives you so many things. It's the Weather Service. Right. It's the Park Service. It's rural hospitals. It's the Education Department. It's student loans. It's the FBI. There are so many targets. And target selection becomes really important. So a communicator can't do a 9-agency litany. You got to do maybe 2, maybe 3 at most. I don't have Poland on this, but I think the veteran stuff is really gold. And if we get people, once they see what they're doing to veterans, then they'll be open to seeing what they do and everything else. But this is a long game. Russell Boyd, they came in prepared to dismantle the entire federal government. Now, one of the things that they're doing that affects a lot of people is cutting back on national parks and also park rangers. And there's a belief in America that is, I understand that people have it, that is utterly wrong. And that is the people that work for the federal government just sit around and do nothing and draw a paycheck. I mean, that's so wrong, you can't imagine. But to show you that, go online and look at the application for a park ranger and look how educated and how skilled and how experienced you have to be. Or you not need to say an FBI agent, need to say air traffic control. Wait, that's something people don't like. We don't have enough air controllers. But the question is really good. And one of the things we're going to continue to talk about on this program, and I hope some of our listeners write in to how we pick our targets, because there's so many. There's so many.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the next question follows that. It's from Will in Richmond, who says, we need our own version of Project 2025, and we need to unapologetically execute it on an every hour, every day. Is anything in the works? Will, let me amend your suggestion. I think there ought to be think tanks and smart people and others developing that. I don't think Project 2025 happened overnight. It was a blueprint, a right-wing radical blueprint that they developed over a number of years. We didn't hear anything about it until 2024. And I think the worst thing in the world would be to try to come out with something every day. Right now, James, I think I've had people who worry about you, and they misinterpret you. They think you're saying Democrats ought to just lie back and, wait later. And I think instead what you're saying is, hey, Democrats are being given issues every day, veterans benefits, cutting Medicaid, tax cuts for the rich, all sorts of issues, and capitalize on those and then develop your own, whatever one calls it, agenda, Project 2025, hopefully more thoughtful and better than what the Republicans did, and at an appropriate time, unveil some of that.
This is precisely. So when I do something to make a point, I try to make it in a memorable way. Okay, and that way you stimulate conversation, all right? And so actually they did, Project 2025 was brought up, the election. Of course, Trump denied you know anything about it, which, like everything else, was a lie. And it was decided maybe correctly that when you told people what Project 2025 was, you would have to explain it to them. That's how the campaign decision making goes. It's all this awful thing. Just so you know, they've been doing this. Trump's going to deny it. Of course, he's going to put all these people in the government. So you're in the campaign. Did we run a spot on what Project 2025 is or not? So it just kind of went away, if you will. Look, they can we can't implement anything. We can't implement anything. Now, could we have some kind of a blueprint that some, intelligent, rational Democrats come up with for 2028? Yes. But they actually told, probably 2025 was actually covered, falsely denied by Trump. A couple of people wrote about it, and it was decided that we weren't going to push it. And looking back, maybe we should have. But that's how these choices get made. And in terms of there's always saying, don't pay attention to what so-and-so says. Pay attention to what so-and-so does. Generally, when I write something and you read it, you're welcome to question me word by word, but a better interpretation is direction. What direction am I talking about? And what the point I was trying to make that you got immediately as soon as you saw it is proceed with caution. And I'm speaking to the House Democratic Caucus tomorrow. It's been in the press, so it's not it's a secret. There's nothing to it. And what I'm going to say, and we've said it on this show 1,000 times, is Bernie Sanders said it yesterday. He's my age, maybe a little bit older than me, but not much, that he has never been more afraid in his entire life. That this is just one of these moments in history where the whole thing could literally go to hell in a handbasket. And what I'm going to advocate is that we act like that. This is a time to be very dignified, very determined, very deliberative, because this is not a political time. This is not the Iraq war that I thought was a bad idea. It turned out that, okay, I was right about that. But I didn't think it was the end of the American experiment. I didn't think it was going to be the end of all of the things that we had, the country and the Constitution and everything. It was a policy error. Is any number of policy errors are made. This is something different. This is something fundamental. And honestly, the only thing that we have to get to the 2026 election, assuming that we win the 2026 election, which we've still got a long way to go, are the House Democrats. And the Senate Republicans, where they have 60 votes, can have an effect also. But we have to be dead serious. We have to understand the challenge that we face. And whatever, however clever we can be, whatever mechanisms are at our disposal, we have to use them wisely, we have to use them intelligently, and we have to be very strategic about it. And this is a very, very serious time. I know everybody wants raging Cajun and go get them and charge and hit them in there and hit them here and hit them high and hit them low and hit them in the middle and kick them. This is not the moment we're in. We're in a different moment. Right. And we have to rise to the moment.
But yes, this really is for any time, more than any time in my lifetime, this is an existential threat to what kind of country we are. And I'm sorry, Al Green standing and shaking his cane or delivering paddle sticks doesn't cut it. Leo in Rancho Mirage, California, I guess this is on that point to an extent, says, is it time to seriously debate and investigate the claim that Trump is a Russian asset? If so, can we stop him?
So, first of all, Rancho Barrage Writers Festival, my dear friend Jamie Cavill, is one of my favorite events that I ever do any time of the year, and, you know, particularly at a time right now. It's just a lovely place, to say the least. Well, I mean, there's not, in my mind, is he a Russian asset? I think he is. But even if he wasn't, he would do exactly what a Russian asset would be doing. they couldn't plan it any better. All right. So I think it'd be interesting if we ever found out, confirm what we all suspect. But if you look at the evidence, it's 100%, whether or not he's paid by the Russians or they have some kind of blackmail on him or he's compromised or whatever they call it, it couldn't be going any better for them. And if he's doing this for free, then they're some shrewd businessmen.
Yeah, he doesn't do much for free. Leo, I think he certainly is tied to the Russians in some way, going back to well before 2016. But, you know, in a way, for now, that train has left the station. And if you're going to talk about priorities, that's not a Democratic priority at this stage. Frank in Lawrence Harbor, New Jersey. Does anyone or any entity in the Democratic Party, is there anyone that could assume a police-like function in light of the Trump administration's lawlessness? Frank, not much. The one exception might be some state attorneys general. I think they're being very active, but and there may be some states where they're engaged in their and their practices, but they control the Justice Department. It is a totally partisan, political, Trump Justice Department now. So I think the idea of a police-like function for the next, at least the next couple of years, is just a dream.
Yeah, you know, it's the hardest thing for a political party to come to grips with. We have no power. That all we can rely on is how wily we are, how clever we are, how we can reframe an issue, how we can bring a focus to some of these things, how we can propose, they'll dispose, but we can propose and we can make them dispose of a thousand popular things. But, you know, we got to put camouflage on our face and a K-bar between our teeth and, you know, a wire cutter and get through the barbed wire and sabotage these guys.
Yeah. James, a final question is coming in from Chris in Savannah. Chris wants to know, why are there so many Democrats fundraising requests? And is there any set goal? Could fundraising messaging benefit from some consolidation?
Boy, okay, first of all, one of my favorite places in the country is Savannah, Georgia. It's just most interesting and very prosperous place. Their port is doing very, very well. Keith Mason told me how well it was doing. Yeah, and I sign a lot of these things. I use my name, and it's kind of funny. People come up to the airport and say, well, you know, you wrote me, and I wrote you back, and I didn't hear back from you. I go, gee, I wrote. I should have known better. I think that one of the things we spent, I don't know, between Future Forward, the Harris Balls campaign, other super PACs, we probably spent easy $2.5 billion. And I don't think we got a single vote that we weren't going to get in the first place. I think every vote we got was a vote that was going to vote Democratic and couldn't stand Trump. And I think Ken Martin is doing an audit, and I think that we should look at that audit and tell ourselves it's not that people are not willing to give money. I think they are. But I think we need to report to our investors what went wrong and how are we going to make it better and how are we going to take this money and put it to better use, because it was not at all put to any good use. And I don't know this, but I suspect a few people got awfully rich in 2024. I mean, awfully rich.
Yeah. Okay, please keep those questions coming in. They are absolutely a highlight of the show every week. Thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon following this episode. Now, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Every Plate and ZBiotics, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.